Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. Alex, who have we got on today?
I'm really excited today because it's Tudors again. We know how everybody loves the Tudors. We have Helen Newsome with us, and she's actually, rather than a historian, she's a historical linguist, and she has a PhD in a very special lady that doesn't get nearly enough attention. Helen, hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Tell everyone who it is that you research.
It is Margaret Tudor, Queen of Scots.
Henry's
Boom. Older sister.
So everybody's always prattling on about Henry, ratbag that he is. But Margaret is like, she is a star in her own right, isn't she? But first of all, people really need to forget about anything they think they know because they saw the Tudors, because wasn't that two sisters of his mashed together to make that character?
Yeah, definitely along those lines, and a bit of fiction in there as well. So they talk about Henry VIII's younger sister, Mary Tudor, who marries the King of France, but they talk about them going off to Portugal, so the whole story is just completely wrong.
They also made her a big slut as well, really, didn't they?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say they weren't.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, not that we're aware of. We're not quite Catherine Howard level.
And we're not going to slut shame anyway. Although Catherine Howard was just silly, but she was young. She was young and stupid. But speaking of not slut-shaming her, her family, however, are planning potential marriages for her when she's five. How is that possible?
Well, you've got to think about that this was a completely different time. People were married at really young ages, and for a royal princess, you were a really valuable commodity. You could be married off to any king or prince, and those diplomatic marriages were really essential to kind of securing peace and to really securing a royal family's kind of status in European politics. So, I mean, it's not an unusual practice in the early modern period, and Margaret was absolutely in no exception. You know, as soon as these babies are born, those marriage contracts are being negotiated.
Tell us what we know about her early life.
What do we know about her early life? Not a huge amount, actually. So she was the eldest surviving daughter of Henry VII and Elizabeth of York. We don't know a whole lot about her education, actually. We know that she was trained in some languages, so she spoke and could write in French and English. She was taught basic writing skills. She could play the lute, and she would have been trained in dancing and kind of embroidery skills. There's a nice mention of her dancing with Henry VIII, and apparently when a royal ambassador came to visit, and apparently Henry VIII threw his jacket off and was quite a performer, where there isn't quite so much discussion of Margaret in that context.
And tell us, what was the Treaty of Perpetual Peace, and what does it mean for Margaret?
Okay, so the Treaty of Perpetual Peace was a peace treaty that was signed between James IV of Scotland and Henry VII of England in 1502. So it was designed to try and secure peace between the two countries because they'd been at war for like two centuries. So it was really designed to try and organise some stability, and was quite like a fundamental part of Henry VII's diplomatic regimes at this time. Margaret's marriage to James IV was a really central part of this treaty, and hence why she was such an important and valuable resource, and why they started negotiating her marriage from such a young age.
She has a really, so they marry her off, don't they, into the Scottish royal family.
Yeah.
She has a really elaborate entry into Scotland, doesn't she?
Yes, she does. Yeah, it's like any kind of royal wedding, celebrated with jousts and feasts and all kinds of like public demonstrations. It must have been a really kind of, I think about this a lot. It must have been a really a phenomenal experience for, I think she was 13 at that point. It must have been such an overwhelming and fascinating experience to be the centre of these marriage celebrations. What's really interesting is that Margaret's first surviving letter is written just shortly after her arrival in Edinburgh, and she writes to Henry VII telling him that she misses him, and kind of reporting on some of the activities of her husband, James IV, and Thomas Howard, Earl of Surrey. And it's such a fascinating document document because the first three quarters of it are written in the hand of a scribe. And then 13-year-old Margaret takes up the pen herself and finishes the letter in her own hand and says, you know, I wish that I was with you right now. And really, you know, really shows the emotional affection and how much she misses her father. So it must have been such a phenomenal experience for her. And she must have known the weight that she was holding through this diplomatic marriage. But it's really fascinating that you can still see some of those kind of personal insights to her as a 13-year-old girl, you know, missing her family. It must have been such a, you know, overwhelming in terms of like leaving home for the first time.
That's mad. So her first marriage, tell us about it. How long does it last? And also as well, so she's only 13 when she gets there. So what happens dynastically? Is there much of a pause before she starts producing children?
Yeah, so we're not entirely sure fully. There's a researcher called Dr. Amy Hayes at the University of the Highlands at the Open University has researched a lot about Margaret's marriages and her her birth. And she suggests that Margaret actually wasn't necessarily intimate with James the Fourth until she was about 16, because even though they married children, they married princesses young, they were really careful to kind of protect them because they knew that, you know, physical intimacy could be really damaging for them. And Margaret's own grandmother, Margaret Beaufort, experienced this directly.
She did, didn't she? Was it only the one child, Henry the Seventh, because she was too young and it basically ruined her body?
Completely. So basically she her marriage, you know, it wouldn't have been kind of consummated probably until a few years after she arrived in Scotland. So Margaret and James IV were married for 10 years before he died at the Battle of Flodden. It seems to have been like a relatively happy marriage from what we can see. I think James IV was apparently quite charming. there's a little bit of speculation that Margaret got a little bit annoyed for the fact that James IV... he had a mistress and he had a number of children by this mistress and that they were housed in Stirling Castle. And some people speculate that Margaret was annoyed by that, but there's not a lot of textual evidence or kind of contextual evidence to actually say that. But I think it was probably a nice period in her life. She had like a strong established king as a husband. She would have had an important role as being a royal mother and a wife. But, you know, she kind of had some support and quite a safe position. It's only after James IV's death at the Battle of Flodden that things kind of get a little bit more difficult for her.
So then James, well, as you mentioned, James dies. Can you tell us about the regency? Doesn't it involve an escape to England?
Yeah. So basically, when James IV dies, in his will, it lists that Margaret is to become the governing regent of Scotland. It's quite an unusual position of power for an early modern woman. She was kind of elected to rule on behalf of her young son, James V, and to rule the kingdom. She does this for, so she becomes regent in September 1513, and then sometime in 1514, she marries for a second time. And it's after this second marriage that the Lords of Scotland decide that Margaret's forfeited the conditions of her regency, and they then call for a French nobleman, a gentleman called John Stuart, Duke of Albany, who's also a descendant of the Stuart line, to come over from France and to replace Margaret as the governing regent of Scotland. It's at this point, and shortly after Albany's arrival in Scotland, that Margaret flees to England. She's really heavily pregnant at this point with her first child, with the Earl of Angus. Apparently she's 8 months pregnant, and she flees over the Anglo-Scottish border on a horseback, which I think, I always kind of like that image of Margaret, you know, escaping out of Scotland.
That's mad, but what a ball ache. Yeah. If you're 8 months pregnant.
Well, apparently she gave birth. She gave birth as like days after she arrived in northern England and was really poorly for a number of months. And she didn't actually travel to the English court for about 6 months after she'd given birth. So, you know, she was really poorly.
She's still quite young, isn't she?
How old is she at that point? She's born in 1489, and that's 15, so she'd have been like 26 or so. So yeah, quite young. I mean, not really young in terms of how many children she's had. I think she was on about child number six by that point, in terms of childbirth, but only the third surviving one to over like about a year old.
Wow. So I just want to, before we're going through her biography, but I've got to ask you, because you have had such access to her correspondence.
Yeah.
You mentioned some stuff from when she was 13, but what kind of woman is she? What do you know about her personality?
What kind of woman is she? That's a really good question. So one thing that I've got to say is that not all of her correspondence survives, okay? So in terms of like archival value, the correspondence that has been preserved is stuff that's really kind of quite dry and political, like politically related. So when she's trying to negotiate peace and things like that. So in terms of like that aspect, trying to understand the personality, you know, we only kind of have access to so much information. But what I would say from that is the fact that she seems to be quite an obstinate and persistent kind of character. She's always writing to Henry VIII saying, please help me with this matter. Please can I have some money? My second husband, the Earl of Angus, is being a pain. Like, how can you treat me like this? So we can't fully know what she was like, but I like to think that she was quite a resourceful and, you know, kind of strong-willed character.
You literally just mentioned her second husband. So yeah, she does marry a second time. Who was he, and was it a successful marriage?
So he's a young, well, he was a young Scottish nobleman called Archibald Douglas, and he was the Earl of Angus. I think he was a few years younger than Margaret. Apparently he was quite dashing and she was swept away with him. Was their marriage a success? I mean, it's safe to say the overarching feeling is no. They spent a lot of their life estranged, and Margaret argued with him a lot and was constantly writing to Henry VIII saying, please, like, get rid of him. She complains that he was always stealing the rents from her dower lands, that he was occupying her houses with his mistresses. And actually, he goes on to, he's sent into exile into France because he's such a pain.
Sounds like a complete dick, doesn't it?
Oh, honestly, it's just such a, not a great second husband, to be honest. James IV looks way better in comparison. And he even, like, takes over the government from her because he's just, like, so power hungry. Yeah, so was it a success? I'd say no.
Yes, let's go really. No. So tell us about Margaret's coup.
So the coup is kind of an interesting episode in Margaret's life. So so as I said, John Stuart, Duke of Albany, is replaces Margaret as the governing regent of Scotland. Now, during his regency, he returns to France a few times and then comes back to Scotland when required. In July 1524, he goes back to France again. He's got a wife. He's got a wife in France. So you know, he doesn't want to leave her all the time.
My God.
I know. Yeah, it's quite controversial. And anyway, so he decides to go back to France to see his wife and to kind of engage in some business matters in France. And it's quite difficult choosing who will replace him during his departure, and it's in this situation that Margaret and a collection of the Lords of Scotland decide to launch a coup and to take control of the government again, and they say that they're declaring that James V is old enough to rule in his own right. I mean, I think he's like about 12 at that point, so
yeah,
he's not.
And the 12 year old boy I know right now can't even like properly function in terms of putting a cycle helmet on, so I'm gonna say no.
Exactly. So people really label it as like Margaret resuming power again and kind of, you know, taking over the government. I don't actually know. I don't personally feel it's probably that kind of clear cut. Margaret and the Duke of Albany had a really turbulent relationship. There's times when she claims that he's a threat to her life and to her son's life. And that's one of the reasons why she flees to England in 1515. But actually, there's times in her life when they seem to get on quite amicably. And I wonder if it was actually more of a kind of a convenient arrangement where Albany was happy to go back to France, was kind of done with governing Scotland, and Margaret was kind of the next best fit. So I don't think it's necessarily quite as simple as them her taking, you know, taking power out of his hands, like, of force. It was actually probably slightly more of a I think it's more of a mutual arrangement, to be honest, from what I've read of her correspondence and the situation.
Do you know what I love about her correspondence? I love the circumstances around her finally getting shot of this idiot husband and her third marriage, because they show her brother, who we're not really going to mention because he's a douche, to be a massive hypocrite later on, don't they? What does Henry say to Margaret when she says she wants a divorce?
Oh, he's just like, disowns her. He's like, what's the point? Like, you know, basically, it's like, you're married in the eyes of God. So, you know, at this point, Henry VIII is theoretically a devout Catholic, so you don't really divorce. And, but what, he's just, I mean, like, just don't do it. But also, Henry VIII was in quite close cahoots with Margaret's second husband, the Earl of Angus. So, and the Earl of Angus actually spends quite a lot of time at the court of Henry VIII. So, Henry's also against Margaret's marriage, not only theoretically because of the religious issue, but also because if she divorced him, it means that he loses some of his influence that he gains through his her second husband, the Earl of Angus.
Oh, yeah, you heard it here. He thinks that she has made her bed and therefore she should lie in it with regard to her marriage. And this is bearing in mind what he's about to do to Catherine of Aragon.
100%. Like, what's really interesting is that it's actually John Stuart, Duke of Albany, this guy who's the governor of Scotland, that actually secures Margaret's divorce for her with the Pope. So I think that's just, it kind of shows you that actually their relationship was actually kind of really quite interesting and probably a bit more dependable than Margaret's relationship with her second husband.
Oh my God, it's brilliant.
The details are quite phenomenal, actually, when you sort of say it out loud.
So tell her about, tell us about the third marriage.
All right, so Margaret is finally divorced in, I think it's 1528. And so before this, she's been estranged from the Earl of Angus for some years. And apparently she's been entertaining a young courtier called Henry Stuart. And finally, when she gets this divorce, she goes ahead and marries Henry Stuart. It's really fascinating because one of Margaret's like messengers is a guy called Patrick Sinclair. He's a really fascinating character. He's kind of been lost to the archives because we don't really know very much about him. And apparently there's a really nice scene that's recounted in correspondence where Margaret actually dismisses Patrick Sinclair, who's been in her service for like 20 years because he doesn't get on with Henry Stuart. I think Margaret probably should have taken that as a bit of a warning that Henry Stuart was not necessarily good for her, but maybe in a kind of older years, she thought, well, why not?
Brilliant.
Yeah, so Henry Stuart, he was eventually made Lord Methven by James V, but I don't think James V massively loved him either, to be honest, but maybe preferred him slightly more to the Earl of Angus. He was a bit less power hungry.
So you've got to credit Margaret with generally wanting to improve relations between England and Scotland, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, you got to sort of think about that this was like Margaret's kind of, this is what she was born and kind of educated and brought up to understand that her job was. Part of being an early modern queen was that you're a royal mother, but also your entire job is to be a peacemaker and a mediator and to secure relations between your native and your marital families. So it was part of their kind of duty, I guess. But also, it's really interesting, this is what the whole PhD is actually on, is that Margaret uses the role of mediator and the relations that she shares between England and Scotland. After her husband James IV dies, she uses this role to kind of negotiate power and greater agency, because it's really one of those things that she's always useful for. She's always useful for trying to facilitate peace, or if things get tough, Margaret's kind of like the nice link and the go-between. So I think definitely it's safe to say that on numerous occasions Margaret is central to kind of facilitating peace and making sure that things run a little bit smoothly, more smoothly between England and Scotland, even though it's not perfectly straight sailing.
Wow. So tell us about her death.
Yeah, so there's not, we don't know huge amounts about her death. She died in October 1541. They think that she probably died from a stroke, but they're not entirely sure. And she was buried at Perth, but unfortunately her remains don't survive. There's actually some research going on where they're trying to locate her remains, but it's not necessarily... they're not going to find her, basically. Mm. And then apparently she wanted all of her belongings to be given to her daughter, Margaret Douglas, who was living in England. But unfortunately, James V just took them and assumed them under the royal crown. So kind of a bit of an anticlimax, really. I'm quite sad about her death. You know, she was such a kind of important figure. It's a shame that we don't have any more evidence of her final kind of... days and kind of, you know, a public memorial of her. I'd really like to see that.
Yeah, that would be a little bit of making up for it, wouldn't it?
Well, I'd like this to be, you know, a nice tomb or something, so I can say that I've stood within a meter of her. Unfortunately, I'll never get to do that. Or I'd quite like to see a crown or something, but unfortunately, we don't have anything.
That sucks. Kind of,
what is nice is that we do have. Some correspondence just sent, I think it's in the May of 1541, so just a few months before she dies. And one of her final letters is sent to Henry VIII. And in this letter, she talks about, she apologises for not writing as much as she normally would. But she says that she's been comforting her son, James V, and his wife because they'd lost two sons, they'd died. So it kind of offers a nice insight into maybe the final year or so of her life where she's kind of quite central to that family unit and is providing kind of some support for her son and his wife and the loss that they've suffered.
She is hugely significant in the history of the monarchy, isn't she? Why is that?
Well... due to Henry VIII's Henry VIII and Elizabeth I's lack of descendants, it's Margaret's great-grandson, James VI, that actually goes on to become the King of Scotland. So Margaret's royal line and descendants actually be the King of England, sorry, it's Margaret's royal line and her descendants that go on to become the King and Queen of England eventually. So it's kind of sad that she's been lost to history, despite being so incredibly significant in our monarchical kind of history.
It is, it's mental, because actually she is like the cornerstone on which the whole thing turns, isn't she?
100%. So incredibly important, but really kind of, as you said, you see with the Tudors programme, she's either morphed into another character or just kind of, she's often a really small footnote, you know, Margaret married James IV of Scotland and that's it. Even in biographies or kind of histories of the period, she really isn't a central character. So that's something I'm really working on and trying to kind of give her the limelight that she deserves.
Oh, well, you definitely sold us.
Oh, thanks.
So thank you so much for coming on to round out this character and make her more than just a sort of bit of levity in the Tudors. And sort of an object of shoehorning in some more sex scenes, because more than that.
She was a cool dude.
She was. And good luck with the book, because I know you're working on putting this into print, aren't you?
I am, yeah. There is going to be an edition of her correspondence. People will finally be able to get their hands on her letters and read what Margaret was like from her own perspective. So hopefully people will get to see a bit more of Margaret through that.
Outstanding. We look forward to it.
Excellent, thank you.
Join us on Monday when Woody's back. Woody's been off doing an amazing amount of hard slog on his own World War II television network. This is, of course, Paul Woodage, who was our Bobfest coordinator. And we promised him and we have been nagging him to come and talk about his own book with us. And it's brilliant. He's going to talk to us all about the story of two Screaming Eagle medics on D-Day. So don't miss that.
Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.